From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, an award-winning journalist is killed in Afghanistan and her colleague wounded. We speak to a reporter in the region about the incident as security concerns intensify.
She's constantly produced, when coming here, a series of photos that capture the humanity of the place, away from the blood and the guts, and photos that told a bit more about the nation as a whole.
We hear why a US Twitter-style initiative in Cuba may have been a democracy backfire, and the storm surrounding the US president, a baseball star, and that selfie.
The White House is not happy. They were not happy that the president's image was being used for commercial purposes, and they made that very clear.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The Associated Press News Agency is expressing grief and sadness at the killing of one of its staff and the wounding of another in Afghanistan. The two AP journalists were shot while covering the run-up to this weekend's presidential election. The attack was reportedly carried out by an Afghan policeman. Malcolm Brown reports on the response to the incident.
AP staff have been told that German photographer Anja Niedringhaus was killed and correspondent Kathy Gannon, a Canadian, was injured. The agency says a freelancer who witnessed the shooting identified an Afghan police unit commander as the attacker. The apparent targeting of two highly experienced journalists is being felt around the world. Here in the US, the National Security Council expressed sadness at the loss of the photojournalist and sent thoughts and prayers to her surviving colleague.
Russia's Federal Security Service says it has detained 25 Ukrainians who were accused of planning terrorist attacks across Russia. According to Russian media, some of the detained include members of the Ukrainian nationalist group Right Sector. But Ukraine denounced the reports as nonsense. Anya Ardayeva reports from Moscow.
In a statement, the Russian Federal Security Service said the Ukrainians had been planning sabotage and terrorist attacks in Russia's Rostov, Volgograd, Tatarstan, Kalmykia and other regions at the time of last month's referendum in Crimea. The Ukrainians have been accused of taking photographs of Russian troop movements and of trying to make contact with extremist elements in Russia. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials claimed Russia sent special agents and explosives to Kyiv during anti-government protests in the capital. Some 100 people died when protesters clashed with police in February.
Police have clashed with protesters in Brussels as 50,000 people from trade unions across the EU descended on the European political institutions. The European Trade Union Confederation organized the march. They campaign against the current EU austerity measures. Water cannons were used on the demonstrators after some hurled oranges and cobblestones at police. It all took place at the Schuman Roundabout in Brussels, the center of European administration. U.S. employers added 192,000 jobs in March, slightly below some forecasts, but still a positive sign that the economy is picking up after the harsh winter. The unemployment rate remained unchanged at 6.7%. Here's Ira Spitzer from New York.
Investors had been eagerly awaiting this latest monthly jobs report, and the numbers were in line with what most observers had expected. Every industry except manufacturing added to payrolls, with job gains strongest in the professional ranks in bars and restaurants. In addition, January and February's job numbers were revised upwards. The increase in hiring over the past 2 months drew more people back into the labor force, leaving the unemployment rate unchanged at 6.7%. U.S. markets edged upwards after the report.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. UK oil and gas companies say they expect to create nearly 40,000 new jobs in the next 24 months because of expansion in areas such as Africa, North America, and the Middle East. 69% of executives from 100 companies surveyed were optimistic about their growth prospects over the next year. UK correspondent Dan Whitehead reports.
Nearly half of the companies asked by the Bank of Scotland, which commissioned the survey, said they were already planning further growth in foreign markets over the next 2 years. Nearly 40% said a shortage of skilled workers would be their greatest challenge. The majority of the UK's oil and gas firms are clustered in Aberdeen and the North East, which means the news is being warmly welcomed by the Campaign for Scottish Independence, a referendum for which is taking place in September. But some question whether the Scottish Government has the expertise and resources to run the industry on its own.
Michael Schumacher is now showing moments of consciousness, according to his agent. The seven-time Formula One winner has been in a coma in France since a skiing accident at the end of December 2013. Jack Perrock has more.
It's been nearly a month since any news on the 45-year-old's condition has been heard. Doctors at Grenoble Hospital in France are trying to wake Michael Schumacher from his medically induced coma. Progress is being made, and Mr. Schumacher's agent says there are now moments of consciousness. The racing driver suffered a severe head injury while skiing off-piste in the French resort of Mirabel just before the new year.
And famed Colombian author Gabriel Garcia Marquez has been hospitalized in Mexico City. Mexican health officials say that the 87-year-old novelist is suffering from a lung and urinary tract infection, but is responding well to treatment. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. A photojournalist has been shot dead and her colleague wounded following an attack in eastern Afghanistan. Anya Niedringhaus, who was pronounced dead at the scene, and reporter Kathy Gannon, whose condition is thought to be stable, were both working for the Associated Press. Reports say they were fired upon while covering a story on the eve of the country's presidential elections. For more on the story, I spoke to Afghanistan correspondent for the Times of London, Jeremy Kelly.
Well, from what we know at this stage, and this comes from statements from AP, who had a local journalist on the ground, and local officials who were present and have spoken to other eyewitnesses. Both the journalists were sitting in the back of a private car inside a police compound in Tanai district of Eastern Host province, which is near the Pakistan border. They travelled there to report on the delivery of election materials for the presidential election, which is, of course, you know, is being held tomorrow. Now, before they were about to leave the compound, what has been described as a police commander, he's a second lieutenant. My understanding is he was in charge of a platoon, about 30 men. He's come up to the vehicle and shouted, "Allah Akbar," God is great, and then unloaded about half his magazine, about 15 bullets is what I'm told. He's then dropped the weapon and surrendered himself without a fight to his colleagues. Now, we know that that Anya was killed instantly, and that her reporter colleague, Kathy Gannon, was struck several times, but her condition is not considered life-threatening. And the latest report we have is that she was being treated at a US military hospital.
Can you tell us, Jeremy, a little bit about Anya Niedringhaus? She was an internationally acclaimed photographer, wasn't she?
Well, I mean, few people who've lived in Kabul would have failed to have seen her work. And most recently, she had a wonderful gallery of Afghan lawmakers. About 70, 69 or 70 women are in the Afghan parliament. And she'd taken a series of portraits of those. And it really, you know, it captured one of the great sort of bits of progress that we've seen in Afghanistan since the fall of the Taliban in 2001. In addition to that, she's constantly produced, when coming here, a series of photos that, you know, many people saw that, like, captured, like, the humanity of the place and sort of away from the sort of, you know, the blood and the guts and like, photos that told a bit more about the nation as a whole.
You've been a journalist working in Afghanistan for some time. Can you try and give us a sense of just how dangerous the region is to report on?
So many of us, like me, have lived here many years. Up until the start of this year, it was considered reasonably safe. Now, your listeners might find that quite unusual, but it was quite easy to go about your everyday business and interact with Afghan life. However, since an attack on a Lebanese restaurant, quite popular with expats and Afghans in January, that brought a sort of new level of terror to the city. Subsequently, we've had a Swedish radio journalist who was shot execution style on the street last month. And in addition to that, there was an attack on another restaurant at a luxury five-star hotel also last month that killed several people, including a very well-known and very popular sort of Afghan journalist who was shot dead with his wife and two of these three children. So Afghanistan, and particularly Kabul, has changed considerably in the past few months. I've heard of no one sort of, you know, packing their bags and flying out tomorrow morning. As you know, the election is going to be held, and, you know, all of us sort of feel, I imagine, a responsibility to sort of cover it to the best of our ability.
And you mentioned there Saturday's election, and that was a story that the two AP journalists were covering when they were shot. That election is going to go ahead, but it's been dogged in corruption rumours for some time now. Can you give us a sense of how stage managed this election process potentially is?
There's certainly a suspicion by two of the three leading candidates that fraud could or might play a big part in tomorrow's poll. I mean, we get to see whether that actually transpires. They're going on the basis of large sort of wholesale fraud that was committed in the previous presidential election in 2009. However, the Afghan election authorities have sort of learned from that that poll, and they've introduced a series of new safeguards that they believe will make it a lot more difficult to commit fraud. Now, no one, whether they be Afghan or indeed Western, is predicting that this is going to be an entirely clean election. However, they hope to sort of limit the amount of fraud so it doesn't affect the credibility of the result.
And, Jeremy, finally, will the soured relations with Washington improve, do you think? Will that long-sought Afghan-US security pact get the signature, the green light that the Obama administration so desires?
Well, of course, many in Washington will be looking forward to the day when President Karzai is no longer president of this country. All the eight remaining candidates, and indeed the three frontrunners who are very much expected to be in position to win this election or indeed a second round, have pledged to sign the security pact. I mean, this will alleviate a lot of fears in the community that Afghanistan won't be abandoned by the international community, but both Washington and indeed a lot of the Afghan public will be happy to see someone who can come in and look at it from a fresh perspective.
Afghanistan correspondent for the Times of London, Jeremy Kelly. This is FSN Reports. The White House have criticised the use of a so-called selfie taken by Boston Red Sox slugger David Ortiz with President Obama as a commercial publicity stunt. Mr. Ortiz took the picture with the Commander-in-Chief during his team's visit this week to the White House. The selfie went viral and was later retweeted by Samsung to promote the phone used to take the image. Earlier, I spoke to political reporter at the Boston Globe, Matt Visor, and asked him why the incident had attracted so much controversy.
The Red Sox were visiting the White House in honor of their 2013 World Series championship. It's kind of a tradition where the president invites winning teams to come to the White House. So it was a day of festivity. The Red Sox had just opened their season in Baltimore, so they were in the area and came to the White House. And it was a fairly festive scene. There was a lot of Red Sox fans who work at the White House in the Obama administration. People from Capitol Hill all over were out on the White House lawn when there was a presentation in which David Ortiz, the Red Sox designated hitter, sort of a very prominent star for the team, gave President Obama a Red Sox jersey, and while doing that decided to use his cell phone and take a selfie, a photo of himself with the president, which was sort of one of the moments of the day, actually. I mean, it was sort of a spontaneous moment, and yeah. Everybody enjoyed it. but later come to find out that Ortiz has had a an agreement with Samsung, which supplied him with the phone, which is and promoted his tweet about with the selfie. So it seemed more of a marketing ploy in the end rather than a spontaneous moment.
Sure, but we haven't had much comment or response to that suggestion from Samsung, and Mr. Ortiz, he says that he was under no directive from the company to do that, to market that picture. It was just something in the moment. But the White House, they're not so happy.
The White House is not happy, and sort of rebuked Samsung yesterday at a daily briefing with Press Secretary Jay Carney, who just 2 days earlier, by the way, was in his Red Sox cap as he started the briefing. So he's a Red Sox fan and an Ortiz fan himself. But they were not happy that the president's image was being used for commercial purposes, and they made that very clear. It does appear that there are some attorneys involved with the White House counsel, although Carney would not specify the types of discussions that they have been having with Samsung.
This isn't the first time Samsung have been, their brand has been at the forefront of a Twitter campaign. We had the Oscars not so long ago, which actually stole a record off of Barack Obama himself.
Yeah, which he sort of joked about with Ellen DeGeneres on her show. Ellen was hosting the Oscars when she took a selfie herself with a bunch of movie stars, which sort of generated a lot of traction on Twitter. So Samsung is, making a habit of this quite successfully, probably from a marketing perspective. For several days, we've been talking about Samsung, and along with David Ortiz. And for several days after Ellen did her selfie, we were talking about Samsung as well. So, you know, in that sense, they probably have to be pleased with this from a marketing perspective.
Right. So it's a marketing win-win. It's an absolute bullseye for Samsung. The White House did object, but Do they lose out here? How damaging is it for them, really? If we can be cynical for a second, do you think they'll be losing any sleep over it?
I don't know if they're losing sleep over it. I do think that it was sort of a moment that they felt the joke was on them in some way. You know, something happened. The president was involved. If you look at that picture, you know, the president is smiling, you know, ear to ear. Ortiz is smiling. You know, it was a very happy moment. And to sort of come to find out that there may have been a little bit more marketing in the works, I think makes the White House a little bit skittish, knowing that they were sort of at least played a role, if an unwitting role, in promoting Samsung and their product.
However, the next time someone, and it needs to be someone of high profile, reaches for their phone and asks the president, hey, smile for the camera. I mean, they might be reticent to do so.
They might be a little bit more nervous, yeah. And might sort of hesitate, or you might have to start signing more disclosures, I guess, if you're with the president with a cell phone.
Right. Well, in the name of transparency, I should just let you know that I did take a selfie during this interview, okay?
Okay. I've not taken one, although in full disclosure, I do not own a Samsung phone.
Political reporter at the Boston Globe, Matt Visor. Now, Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has put Africa's dependence on aid down to laziness as the country's anti-homosexuality bill continues to draw further threats of sanctions against the country. President Museveni was speaking at the National Thanksgiving Ceremony in the capital, Kampala, to celebrate the enactment of the law. The controversial bill has seen support withheld by some Western donors, as our Africa correspondent Isabel Nakiria reports.
President Museveni told the nation Africa is abundant with wealth but can only do without aid if the people learn to generate income for themselves.
Because we are lazy. That's an internal weakness. What aid does Uganda need? Uganda will grow 2 crops in a year. In Europe, they grow only 1 crop because of the winter. How can people who can grow 2 crops beg from the ones who have got only 1 crop?
His comments come after Ugandan officials met with EU counterparts this week amid the threat of further sanctions over the bill. The European Parliament said the anti-homosexuality bill is violating human rights and democratic principles. But the Archbishop of the Church of Uganda, Stanley Ntagali, warned that no intimidation would change the nation's perception on homosexuality.
By my biblical tradition, or the tradition of the Quran, by my heritage, I have nothing to apologize for. We must value our culture and defend it vigorously. The culture of Ugandans, the African culture, must be guarded and defended jealously.
Bishop Christopher Ssenyonjo was expelled from the Church of Uganda for speaking out for homosexual communities in 2006. He says homosexuals need help, and he is willing to provide that through counseling.
Because you could see that there are people who need to be rehabilitated, probably whom we can say can change. For instance, if somebody got involved in homosexuality when he was in prison, I've known prisoners, not because they really would like it, but because of the pressure, sexual urge. Now, those people, when they definitely leave prison, they wouldn't like to continue in that kind of life. But they need rehabilitation, and they definitely change.
Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni last month signed the anti-homosexual law that punishes offenders with life imprisonment. Western donors have withheld aid to the country, and the U.S. warned it would complicate relations with Uganda. But President Museveni has warned the West about teaching him what to do, saying Uganda is a sovereign state. I'm Isabel Nakiria in Kampala.
The State Department has denied the U.S. was attempting to overthrow the Cuban government through the creation of a Twitter-style program. Spokeswoman Maria Harf says the program was unique to the communist nation.
There was nothing classified or covert about this program. Discreet does not equal covert. We generally do promote freedom of expression, and in hostile environments like this one, go to great lengths to make sure they are done discreetly.
The operation was started in 2009, but wound down 3 years later. It was set up by the U.S. Agency for International Development to promote freedom and democracy in Cuba. Mark Hansen is a senior associate for Cuba at the Washington office on Latin America and spoke to me earlier.
So AP broke the story just earlier this week on a secret USAID paid for program that was implemented by government contractors, U.S. government contractors, to set up a platform for cell phone users in Cuba to communicate among themselves. But it turns out that they were also pushing messages out on that same platform from time to time without letting anybody know exactly where they're coming from and who was sponsoring it.
So what were they trying to achieve with this?
Well, there seemed to be a variety of answers coming out on that front. Most straightforwardly from the reporting of AP, it appears that they were looking to, in some ways, gather understanding around people and their political beliefs and their willingness to potentially participate in opposition politics. Now, they were also simply trying to put together a platform for Cubans to exchange ideas among themselves. So it's hard to say exactly what they're going for. At the end of the day, it shut down because they couldn't sustain the costs, and they were in an awkward position where the U.S. government was paying the Cuban government for use of its cell service.
So if this was an attempt to promote democracy in Cuba, from what we understand, did it actually achieve its purpose?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And it certainly undermined any reform movements and movement towards opening in Cuba. I mean, when you think about the relations between the two countries, you can't have the United States both impose an embargo and suggest that they're in it for the well-being of the Cuban people. You can't have it both ways. And so certainly it didn't get us anywhere closer to democracy. If we really want to go that direction, we need to open up our own system and allow Americans to travel freely to Cuba, allow us to, Americans to conduct commerce with the Cubans, and over time reestablish better relations. At that point, we might have a role to play in making suggestions about how the Cuban government should open up. But in the meantime, it's very hard for the U.S., who has for 50-some-odd years sought to isolate and undermine this government in Cuba, to play a constructive role in the reform process.
How aware are we of other USAID initiatives?
Well, look, if Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont was on a television show yesterday saying that he was unaware. Now, Senator Patrick Leahy is both very involved in Cuba, but he's also in charge of funding the entire foreign operations of the United States government. He says he doesn't know about the program. So if he doesn't know about the program, very few people do in its entirety. And that kind of transparency should be a fundamental part of what a development agency works on. And if it's not going to be that kind of transparent, or if it's not going to be transparent in that fashion, it's probably a different agency that should be working on.
Mark Hansen, Senior Associate for Cuba at the Washington Office on Latin America. Now, the only Silicon Valley startup accelerator exclusively for Israeli entrepreneurs is launching a new program focused on closing the gender gap in the technology sector. In collaboration with the Google for Entrepreneurs initiative, UpWest Labs plans to invest in growing the community of female entrepreneurs, both in Israel and Silicon Valley. Rebecca Bowring reports from California.
This is what we do.
This is my team. Shuli Galili knows what it takes to be a changemaker. She's had a hand in accelerating more than 500 fledgling Israeli businesses and spent over a decade strengthening ties between Silicon Valley and Israel. Now she's turning her attention to bridging another divide, gender. Statistics show that Silicon Valley remains largely the preserve of white male CEOs. According to the Center for Venture Research, only 16% of businesses seeking funding in the first half of last year were owned by women.
We have robust explosion of many, many entrepreneurs today trying to build businesses and grow them. And the fact that there is a very small percentage of that opportunity presented to female founders, I think, is unacceptable.
Startup accelerators offer fledgling businesses access to mentorship, contacts, technology and office space, aiming for a return on their investment. Two of the six small companies housed at this one are run by women. Galili says that although Israel has in some ways empowered its females to take command, that hasn't translated into the business world.
Even though we all serve in the military and we all have the opportunity to have leadership roles in that institution, I think still, if you look at the tech sector in Israel, there are only 10% women who are starting companies.
28-year-old Sharon Savariego is CEO of Leaders, a platform that enables organizations to leverage the power of the community. She and her team came to Palo Alto about 2 months ago.
Since we arrived here, we got a lot more requests. We have bigger organizations contacting us. And what we can see is that this is really the point when we can enhance everything that we did so far.
And she says she was taught from a young age that gender has no bearing on success.
There is no limit. So there is no limit, there is no difference. Whatever you want to do, you can just go and do it.
In partnership with Google, UpWest Labs is now aiming to prove more female entrepreneurs can just go and do it. Their new program will run seminars and events bringing together businesswomen and investors motivated to fund female-led startups. To date, UpWest Labs has supported 33 startups which have together raised more than $20 million in funding. Among their co-founders, women have been four times more numerous than is on average the case in Silicon Valley. An example the team hope will be replicated across more small businesses thanks to their efforts. Rebecca Bowring, Palo Alto, California.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show by emailing us reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Monday, our special report on the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide and the ongoing fight for justice. That's Monday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.